This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Let me just start with a little quote from Theodore Rethke as a kind of a quote overhanging the talk. It's a line from one of his poems, quote, "She moved in circles and the circles moved." So this, I'll just start. The visual culture surrounding the racialized female body tells a relentless story about the ineluctable modality of the visible. But how do we know we are seeing what we're seeing? What are the conditions under which we see? As Martin Jay has reminded us, all the Western culture has long been thought of as ocular-centric. Its philosophic tradition from Plato to Lacan has in fact harbored a deep suspicion, even denigration of the realm of the visual, which is often equated with illusion and superficiality. This is, of course, why the discourse of beauty is also a discourse about deception. Today, the moral economy of the visual continues to exert its hold, especially when it comes to representations of women and racial minorities. The visual is almost always negatively inflected and seen as a tool of commodification and objectification. It is not a coincidence that in the field such as Asian African American studies and African diasporic studies, the locus of revolutionary possibility often gets located in sound or music. Gilroy, Wahili, Moten, you know, et cetera. While the visual remains a less than productive arena. And where the visual does get recuperated in liberal rhetoric, it seems limited to gestures of idealization or authentication. But neither the post of vilification nor veneration can adequately address the phenomenological, social, and psychical contradiction inhering in what it means to be visible, especially for a subject all once at once, all too seen and not seen at all. The very idea, for example, of a public, beautiful Asian woman seems very fraught. Is her beauty disruptive of or complicit with racial and gender stereotypes? What do we do with the uncomfortable fact that racial legibility is the ground on which both discrimination and affirmation are made? If all good feminists, film theorists, and indeed arguably the whole Western philosophical thinking are telling us that the realm of the visual is morally corrupt, then what can beauty or an ethical position look like for the modern viewer and the producer of racial image? To answer these questions, we have to venture beyond the moral economy of the visual and interrogate the conditions under which a race and gender body comes into visibility at all, especially at the beginning of the 20th century when vision and modes of seeing are undergoing radical transformation. In 1929, in the film directed by E.A. Dupont and recently restored to the British by the British Film Institute entitled Piccadilly, the iconic anime one appeared in a dance number that epitomizes her appeal for the Western audience. And I'm going to give you a little plot summary in case you haven't seen the film. In the story, one plays Shosho, a Chinese dishwasher who was discovered in the basement scullery of the Piccadilly Club, and then given the chance by Valentine Wilmot, which is the club owner, to perform publicly upstairs in the general ballroom. Right? So the Cinderella story is entwined also in a kind of a sordid plot involving Shosho displacement of the club's regular star, Mabel Greenfield, both on stage but also off stage in Valentine's affections. So what I'm going to do now is show a brief, not a brief, but kind of 4 minutes, which is a little bit extended, but I wanted you to get a sense, it's really important to get a sense of the sequence. This is a scene of Shosho's first public performance, the one that launched her into stardom, and as you will see, it's a primal scene around which my talk will circle. So let's see the clip. So this scene of classic Orientalist performance is arresting for several reasons. Not for its cliches, but for its cinematographic display. Although replete of color, the film is so light infused as to appear more than black and white. Four large strobe lights circle the foot of the diegetic stage, shooting a round of golden ricocheting lights around the ballroom. And in the middle of this shimmering, vertiginous ring, we find Wang herself moving dreamily, barely clad, clad in bare skin and metal, a column of radiance that both draws and deflects the gaze. The dance of lights throughout the sequence, spilling across the faces of the diegetic audience, literalizes the web of fascination that one weaves, but it also serves to encompass the audience and the spectators within the world of her trance. I'm interested in the poetics of visuality, indeed of light itself, evoked by the scene of enchantment. What do we make of this brilliance and of this body, of this brilliant body? At first, it may seem all too appropriate that this episode of fetishized, orientalized femininity should be staged with an obsessive attention to bling. After all, in contrast to primitivism, which deploys a rhetoric of nakedness, orientalism from Mata Hari to Afua Moy has always reflected the specularization not of naked skin, but of ornament, the excess covering and decoration that supposedly it epitomized the West's overdeveloped civilization and hence stock pages, and hence effeminized and corrupt civilization. We also know that shine plays a key role in Freud's meditation on fetishism, an essay, by the way, that displays more intensely his sartorial preoccupation. In the often cited case of the young man who has exhausted a certain shine on the nose into a fetishistic precondition, Freud accounts for this very odd choice of objects by unpacking the series of substitution that choice affects. This is a quote from Fetishism. The surprising explanation of this was that the patient has been brought up in an English nursery, but had later come to Germany, where he forgot his mother tongue almost completely. The fetish, which originated from his earliest childhood, had to be understood in English, not German. The shine on the nose in German, Glanz auf der Nase, was in reality a glance at the nose. The nose was thus a fetish, which incidentally he endowed at will with the luminous shine which was not perceptible to others, end quote. This is that famous quote from Freud about the shine on the nose. Thus, in Freud's analysis, shine was not just a psychical substitution, standing in for the nose, standing in for the missing maternal penis, but also a linguistic displacement, glance mistaken for glance. For Karl Marx, too, shiny surfaces signal commodity fetishism, where for Freud, fetishism arouses and cancels the knowledge of castration. For Marx, fetishism arouses and cancels the knowledge of alienated labor, and the shine, of course, covers over that alienation. In these contexts, Shosho epitomizes the commodification of the feminized and the Asiatic in labor production, both versus the laborer as a dishwasher and now as a performer, right? In sum, there are plenty of sound reasons for understanding Wang playing the scullery maid turned star as the quintessential fetishized object, and for understanding the lure of Xing in the scene as its symptom. But these readings, however accurate, cannot quite dispel a host of other lingering questions. Who is doing the watching, and what about the proliferation of object and objectness in this scene? Are we assured or assaulted by the imagined plenitude of light? What happens when shine falls on everybody and not just the object, the fetishized object? If we consider this performance to be a strip act of some sort, then it is a curiously blinding one. Her costume is made of layered sequins and spangled breastplate and girdle. The glare bounces coolly and brilliantly off her breasts and hips, at times making it almost impossible to look at her. This is not a body penetrated by gaze exactly, but one that is rather clad in a resistant gleam. If the lure of sheen is meant to protect the fetishist from the threatening lack underneath, then here that sheen seemed to tip into downright aggression against the scopic eye, the paradox of the Medusa. Not only are we looking at the audience, looking at Shosho, but Valentine, as we saw, is also watching his client, watching his investment, and then offstage, Mabel is watching her competition in enthralled horror. And then there's a camera eye which tracks circularly a point, which also means that the only point of view that can sweep the audience is a privileged one in the middle, which is to say the point of view shared by the transcendental camera, and I would suggest by the transcendental Shosho. For now, and I'll explain what I mean by that, but for now, it suffices to say that the camera spends as much time on the diegetic audience as it does on the dancer, reminding us that the audience in the film is also on display. They, too, bear the imprint of light, suggesting that Shosho's shiny body is really less of a screen and more of a mirror, less of an object than an agent of projection. Walter Benjamin, who, by the way, was also entranced by Anna May Wong, he met her once and had written about her very briefly. Quoting Proust, once observed that, quote, people who are fond of secrets occasionally flatter themselves that object retains something of the gaze that has rested on them, end quote. And we can say that Xiuxiu's shiny body has been made to bear, to be the repository of looks bestowed upon her. But we also have to hasten to add that her brilliance suggests, moreover, that the object can also look back. The mesmerized audience in that reflective ballroom is entranced and arrested by their own looking. This scene thus offers us something of an essence of an anatomy of fascinations and show us that to be fascinated is not to enjoy distance from the commodified object, but to feel contact with it. More specifically, to experience empathy for the imagined pleasure of objectification, of self-objectification, to relish that slide from me to it. And we are, of course, implicated as well in this pleasure of self-immobilization. When the flickering light leads us to the watching audience in the film, we are thrown back, of course, to our own watching. It is as if we're being reminded that the true object of fascination in this cinematic experience is light itself. What is the pleasure of cinema as a sensual experience, if not the fantasy that we confuse our eyes to light? Could it be that we're being offered here not the enthrallment of body as lack, but the enthrallment of participating in the confusion between shine and glance? If we recall, there is an odd interlude right before, in the middle of the scene, the sequence, right before we got to a show show's very sort of dazzling performance, when the camera pans from left to right, showing nothing but a dark, blurry black screen for like, you know, a good 20 seconds. This awkward eclipse makes no diegetic or spatial sense, except as a means of drawing attention to the contrast of light to follow, and as I'm suggesting now, as a way of underscoring the alliance among light, visuality, and the fantasy of corporeal presence that is the gift of cinema. The supposed fetish has become the precondition not for psychical blindness, but for literal vision. The alignment between Xiuxiu and cinematic possibility itself, rather than Xiuxiu as a symptom of cinematic pleasure, compels us to interrogate what does it mean for us to see a body that is not really there. For a sex icon, Anna May Wong's body is curiously perspective. In contrast to her erotic and professional competition, Mabel, who was played by Gilda Gray, who was, by the way, at the time more famous than Anna May Wong, whose Rubenesque white body is constantly being corporealized and weighted down. She's often pictured as leaning on something or about to fall down. She's all about weight, in other words. In contrast to that, however, Xiuxiu's body, when it is revealed, is almost shockingly sparse, boyishly slim, childlike, ribbed, clad in scales and spikes. And the way they dance also emphasizes difference. The former, that is the Mabel, I didn't show you the scene, but she does kind of like a Charleston show earlier. The former makes us feel the weight of her body, the rise and fall of her Charleston, the exertion of her shimmy, a style that she was known to have originated, the heat of her routine showing itself in her flushed face and bouncing headdress and feathers. Right? Xiuxiu's bodily movements, in contrast, are cool and light, almost ephemeral in their slow sways and spirals. Where Mabel is all about showbiz, Xiuxiu is all about geometric reverie. Where Mabel covers ground, Xiuxiu is all concentric circles. Thus, while our contemporary culture might presume the skinny body to be the desirable one, this is not, in fact, the case in 1929 in Great Britain, any competition against the famous Gilda Gray, a much more polished and established star. The preference for Wong slash Xiuxiu is hardly guaranteed, right, by the times. Indeed, she wins the competition not by drawing on a visual rhetoric of fleshly availability, but by its opposite. From our first sight of Xiuxiu to a tragic demise in the end, the most sensuous thing about Xiuxiu has always been not her flesh, but what she did with her clothes. Hence the film's sartorial rather than corporeal preoccupation whenever surrounding the figure of Wong. The first time we, the first sustained shot of Wong in the film comes in the form of the camera's meditation on a long stocking run on Xiuxiu's black stocking legs, right? And the camera will linger again on this tear much later on her skin when she makes her second appearance. While this detail must have been intended to invoke a Victorian sense of titillation and most certainly to connote Xiuxiu's class status, it also signals the beginning of a series of sustained association between Xiuxiu's skin and the synthetic materials that cover it. The film appears fascinated by the hide-and-seek that Xiuxiu's body seems to embody, again, the sort of striptease motif, but the promised striptease never actually reveals a real body underneath. For example, upon making the tricky decision of giving the very inexperienced Xiuxiu a chance on the show floor, Valentine, you know, the owner, immediately proceeds to worry, not about her choreography or about her rehearsal, but her costume. Those of you who have seen the film will recall the rather extraordinary sequence in the film when Xiuxiu insists on what kind of costume she ought to wear for the debut and where to buy it. She leads Valentine to the place where she wants to buy the outfit. In the back room of a Chinese restaurant at the Limehouse District, in which Xiuxiu directs Valentine, she proceeds to dictate almost all of the terms involving a decision about how to dress her body. And among the soft silk and colorful silks that draw Valentine's eye, Xiuxiu picks instead this most armor and prickly of costumes. And as she says, "I dance in that or not at all." Now, this entire exchange is overlaid with heavy erotic suggestions, the back of a seedy restaurant, as a makeshift dressing room, the man haggling over the price of the costume, when it is clear that they're also haggling over social sexual attention. The erotic charge of the scene, however, relies not on the exposure of Xiuxiu's body, but its fantasized presence. That is, when Valentine asks Xiuxiu, when he asks to see her in her new costume, opening the door for a perfect moment of heterosexual male prurience, instead of complying, Xiuxiu asks her other loved interest in the film, played by King Ho Chen, and he plays a character called Jim. She asks Jim to try on the dress instead. So she asks her boyfriend to try on the dress on her dress instead, right? So this is sort of an exquisite moment in the film when Valentine looks Jim over, up and down, right, checking him out, presumably contemplating the costume, but clearly also trying to imagine Xiuxiu's body in the costume through the body of Jim. So we see Valentine, for example, even like lifting the breastplate to see what's underneath. In short, in this scene of voyeurism is all about the approximation of Xiuxiu's body rather than its revelation. And in this fraught scene where the Asian female body is, so to speak, on the block, that body appears to be its also most self-staged and displaced form. And male heterosexual voyeurism can only express itself as a kind of homoerotic exchange. We might say that this scene literalizes the ultimate paradox of Freudian heterosexuality, a man looking for a man inside the woman, which is really what fetishism is about. The Swan's racial performance are such that they enable us to see the veils through which we think we see radically destabilizing the certitude of what Fanon had pronounced the epidermal schema. That is, the racist imagination has long assigned racialized body to rawness, animality, and the inhuman, while critical race theory has done the vital work of unraveling those assumptions as entirely socialized and juridicized notions. But somehow, even in critical race theory, the fact of blackness continue to signify unproblematically. In her foundational essay, Whiteness as Property, for instance, Cheryl I. Harris demonstrates how social privilege and subordination are structured on entwined concept of race and property. And in doing so, she elegantly and powerfully undoes the fact of whiteness. But the fact of blackness surfaces in the form of nostalgia for black authenticity, most notably in her mourning for her grandmother, who spent her time passing as a white and has not been able to really be herself. Right. In a way, critical race theory has given us a racial schema, but robbed us of skin as a complex negotiation between corporeality and fantasy. Part of my inquiry into Wang's sartorial play has been motivated by the larger question of what happens when we fundamentally alter the skin equal flesh diet that structures races and racial imaginations. I have been trying to attend to the material possibility of visible race skins, not by insisting or recuperating its corporeal or biological authenticity, but by attending to the curious interface between that skin and the various projections that it both receives and generates. In Piccadilly, the spectacularization of yellow skin, the moment that should have been some equivalent to pronounce, you know, look, it's a Negro, coincide instead with that skin's dematerialization into the blinding spills and shimmers of light across surface. More than redeeming the abjection of yellow skin and the yellow peril that it implies, Wang's transformed golden body in the scene harnesses the power of glitter in ways that produces the possibility of a new material objectness that has yet to be accounted for in the politics of race. We have already observed that her shininess can function like a mirror to look back on the viewer. And now I want to go further and think about how shininess operates a kind of animated surface, right, for Wang. Right around the time that this film was made, shine as a concept was enjoying its own currency in the visual culture. Artists, especially sculptors in the 20s and 30s, were enthralled by the possibility of sheen. Sculptors such as Brancusi and Henry Moore wrote and spoke about a symbolic and active value of shine to, quote, enhance, curve, and lead the eye around, end quote. Shininess came to embody for them a host of ideas about modernity and technology. But even more than connoting the machine age and the plastic age, shininess for these artists presents the means through which they could release sculpture from its material condition and open it up to new meanings. We might say that shine enables precisely the exchange between the organic and the inorganic, as well as promote the communication between visuality and the other senses. Hence, shine became thought of as capable of imputing motion and sound, and even more intensely, shine came to embody ideas about erotic potential and originary radiance. And sound, apparently. Suddenly, we see shine as more than a description or a quality of light, but as a mode of relationality, a medium through which the visual and the sensorial fuse. Are we now seeing something about a relationship between shine and glance, not as linguistic displacement, but as a kind of phenomenological repetition? The metallic shine on Wang's body, instead of iterating the confinement of objectification, which it does, it also nonetheless the unexpected work of releasing her body from its visual limits and of mobilizing the forms around that body. By firing her body up with light and by stretching that light all around the room, by cladding her in gold and by repeating the gold in the objects surrounding her, the mise-en-scene expands her outline and produces an animated and multisensorial surface that both decorporealizes and extends her body. This is not just a white audience's dream or even Valentine's dream. This is also a Xiuxiu's dream. Earlier, I mentioned that the flickering light can be seen as symbolizing the web of fascination that she weaves. Let us go further and suggest in this scene that web of light is also about extending Xiuxiu's psychical sphere. This is a scene of interiority as much as it is of exteriority is underscored by the scene's tonal stillness as well by Xiuxiu's apparent self-containment. Moreover, let us think about the ways we might read the scene not as merely ornamental, but as in fact profoundly cosmological. Xiuxiu literally moves her audience by remapping the specular geography of the stage. And let me explain what I mean by that. As Godfrey Semper has reminded us, the ancient Greek word for adornment, which is cosmo, means both ornamentation and world order, right? This is why the words cosmetic and cosmo share etymological root. Far from being simply superfluous, ornament aligns itself with cosmic laws. The object of ornament becomes a macrograph of the visible world and a dynamogram, which is this word, of the invisible forces of the universe. Thus, instead of dismissing this visual field as another Orientalist decoration and mysticism, might we not really consider its symbology, or more intriguingly, consider it as a meditation on the nature of symbology? Here, ornaments, from the tower on her head to the spheres at her feet, all suggest rather classic iconic inferences, creating a luminous diagram. In his Problema to Style, for instance, Semper identifies a category of ornament. He sort of categorized ornamental artifact in his highly compulsive way. But anyway, he identified a category of ornamental artifact, which he calls directional ornament. And the first example is, of course, her her headdress, right? For Semper, directional ornament, that's such as spheres, spears, towers, and etc., not only follow and enhance bodily movement, but they also dynamically represent what we today would call prosthetic possibilities, right? By expanding bodily periphery through the extension of inanimate objects. The spear or the tower that Shosho chose to wear for her performance can be seen as an extension of a bodily and psychical boundary, creating a new outline, at once corporeal and fictional. And we will see another version of this Shosho's ability to co-opt fictional and subjunctive spaces earlier in the film when she signs a contract for her performance of Valentine, and the camera gives a very quick glimpse of her signature, right? And you see that she has signed not only in Chinese rather than in English, but she also signed her real name, Anna May Wong's real name in Chinese rather than Shosho's, right? Thus breaking the boundary of the world of the film and the circumscription of the contract, writing herself both out of and into the film. Another category identified by Semper is the circle, which is, of course, the dominant shape of the scene. It is inscribed in the choreography, the movement of her arms when she does this thing, the body placement, the stage prop, even the circular stage, which frames her behind her. Semper tells us that the ring is considered microcosmic because it operates as a kind of circular antenna, collecting forces of the universe and conferring them on the body that it adorns. This is why royalty wears crowns, of course. Indeed, the circle appears as the perfect analog for Shosho's particular mode of simultaneous self-expansion and self-containment. The audience and the lights fly around her so that even as she is the dancer, it is as if the scene is also dancing around her. Can we see the slide now? Are we looking at an Asiatic revision of the birth of Venus, which is one of the founding myths of Western aesthetics? Architectural and cultural theorist Spyros Papapetros, in speaking about a history of ornamentation, has invoked that Renaissance masterpiece as a pictorial meditation on what he calls mobile accessories. This is a description by Papapetros. Quote, "While looking at Botticelli's Birth of Venus, one might even argue that the entire canvas is essentially an ornament. The painting represents an annual ornament, or the ring, the way that fabric and hair appear to circulate around Venus, orbiting around the axis of her marmoreal body like satellites. Venus stands at the very center of this commotion of accessories," end quote. And we could say something similar about Shosho's theatrical birth, that the entire ballroom, alight with jewel-like reflection, faceted by glances, itself constitutes an ornament, a microcosm of the universe, with Shosho in its center emitting the stars and lights that scatter around the spheres of this room. I'm trying to get at a particularly intense way that Wong reappropriates Orientalist ornamentation and in doing so reinvests them with an aural concentration that enable her to assume, even induce, the world in which she performs. How can we not notice that the strobe lights resembling four glittering globes sitting at Shosho's feet, anchoring the four corners of an imaginary cartography? And what would it mean for us not to see this moment as a moment of reduction, but as a moment of suspension, a moment of radical expansion where Shosho has remapped the universe with herself as its center? Her relationship to Orientalist and feminine adornment is at once predictable and extraordinary. It compels us to reconsider the role that ornament and aesthetic practice played in the visual culture surrounding the racialized female body. It also hints at how we might begin to put our finger on the intense and, I think, idiosyncratic quality about Wong as a performer. In the world of this film, Wong is not so much subversive as she is simply possessive. And my reference to the Botticelli may not seem so far-fetched when we recognize this cinematic scene as also a reinvention of the myth of Venus. Here, not the iconic blonde Venus, nor her abject inverse, the black Venus, but a third figure whose yellow-gold body mediates between luminous and excrescence, between the aural and the carapace. Are we witnessing an epistemological transition? Art historian Edgar Wynne has argued that the Botticelli painting represents the originary fragmentation, the primary fracture of the world, following the castration of Uranus, from which Venus was born, a myth that was described by Hesiod and then later by Plato in the Republic. In this account, the birth of the decoration of sign itself emerges from originary loss. This ornamentation both represents the sign of originary loss as well as its reparation. Xiuzhi's performance also negotiate lack and compensation, though not in a classic Freudian way. If, according to Wynne, the Botticelli represent the original fragmentation of cosmic matter, the original division of the thing with a big T into thing into a little t, then in this encounter between East and West, we are giving an Asiatic Venus turning her own ruptured thingness into the plenitude of thing with a big T and originary radiance. In other words, sign is being offered here as a referent. I do not mean to offer the archetypal as a solution against the stereotypical. Rather, I want to insist upon attention to the animation of objecthood that serves as a foundation for Xiuzhi's dream of subjecthood in this moment in which her dreams come true. Right? It is a dream that seduces the audience both inside and outside of the film. We thrill not to a rarefaction, but to her megalomania. And I think this is even true for the diegetic audience, even if they would not have been capable of recognizing that. This is why they were held by her, right? Sustained by her in that extraordinary moment. This extraordinary moment of assumption on Xiuzhi/Wang's part is, of course, temporary. We will have to emerge from this gorgeous dream to the sordid reality of Piccadilly Square and the Empire in 1929. But just as Xiuzhi herself will be extinguished at the end of the film. But for the duration of this performance, Xiuzhi is more than just another little Chinese girl dancing. She is here the transcendent force who wields the erotic power of signs. Can a race body be glamorized? And is glamorization never more than an iteration of commodification and objectification? Wang's body of reverie may offer us an important critique into the discourse of flesh shared by racists and liberals alike. Feminist and race critics have been invested in recovering the flesh made into thing and then devastated. This is a paraphrase from Hortense Spillers. The racialized body has long provided a fecund source of irresistible and destructive sensuality, rendering that body into a thing, what Spillers has called being for the captor. Ruptured flesh does serve as a crucial and ethical reminder of the injuries inflicted on that body. The exoticized Asian female body may be rightly said to bear the same crisis and inscription. But what I have been trying to explore suggests that the racialized female body may also enact different kinds of body things and different kinds of body writing. This earliest century race beauty offers a crucial evidence of a pivotal moment, maybe even a pause, between the cult of personality and the commodification of personality. A song in illumination, Wang's body registers rather than veils or overlooks the taut intimacy between thingness and personhood. In the end, it is the extravagance of semiotics rather than embodiment that proves to be the source of Wang's enduring fascination. Thank you. So I'm happy to, I don't know if you have time for that, we can talk. Well, I think that I think the sort of moral economy, right, would suggest. There are very apparent and easy and quick way of offering a moralistic critique, right, of this sequence, and that would go along with a kind of primitivist reading or an orientalist reading certainly a feminist reading, right. But I think that if we, instead of seeing the very thing that might be the object of denigration, her very objectness, right? I guess part of the argument is trying to suggest that objectness, which is always the bad guy when it comes to feminist and race rhetoric, may not be, there may be different kinds of objectness at stake, right? And that the kind of objectness that Wang is engaged with in this scene may be said to actually not only suggest a different kind of objectness outside of the moral economy of bad objects, right? But in fact might even lead us to really radically rethink how certain kind of critical race rhetoric have led us to actually repeat that notion of object, to sort of re-secure that. I mean, the thing that I think is really, you know, fascinating and troubling always about Fanon for me, and in fact, you know, a history of critical race theory following Fanon, is precisely that, you know, it aims to deconstruct the biology of race, and it does so by giving us the epidermal schema. But that epidermal schema so easily slips right back into some not biological, but some kind of inescapable. And this is why Marianne Dong would say, you know, visibility for the race and female subject is inescapable. And then Homi Bhabha would say that racial fetishism in colonial history is not a secret at all. It is an inescapable fetish, right? And part of what I'm interested is that if you are the fetish, is there in fact no escape, right? And then to go further and say, but not to be satisfied with saying escape in the sense of subversion, right? That, oh, she subverts this, you know, by parodying it or something like that. So I'm trying to get at, you know, different ways of thinking about agency, different ways of thinking about objectness that don't quite fit into an easy moral schema. I don't know if that answers your question. No?
Thinking Claire Kendry, and I wondered how you would, because you have the white Venus, the black Venus, and the woman's third, but I wondered how you would extend this back to the black Venus. And I was also thinking in terms of, you know, that same modernist period, just like the word shine to describe African American men, you know, like how shine is working in that context.
Yeah. And actually, you know, there's also this whole discourse, which is, I actually been trying to, and anyone could direct me, it'll be great. I haven't found anything written on it, but I just sort of know that actually, in fact, in sort of oral tradition, there's also, there's that, you know, shine is often linked to jazz and mojo. I mean, there's a whole sort of like musical rhetoric about this, right? Though I haven't read anyone who has written about it, and I would love to. So anybody who knows anything about this should email me and let me know. But yes, I actually think that it's a very interesting question because the history of shine, and the person to read about this, one person to start reading about this is Krista Thompson, who's an art historian, and she has a book, she has an article already out, but she has a book forthcoming about the history of shine, basically, in relation to race skin. And she starts by saying that from the 16th century on, and her reading is closer to the Marxist reading, right? That is to say that the black skin has always been made to be shiny as a kind of commodity, right? So during auctions, for a slave auction, the bodies would be greased down and things like that. And so that shine has such a long history related to corporeal, to commodification, right? And it's precisely because shine has that sort of corporeal residue implication that when you look at, when you go to someone like Richard Dyer talking about the cult of light in Hollywood, he would say that, I mean, he makes a very famous argument that Hollywood lighting is, you know, racially, ideologically inflected, that it's not only made for white women, but about the whiteness as an ideology, it's transcendence, goodness, purity, blah, blah, et cetera, right? And he offers an example of Lillian Gish and so forth. And he says that, in fact, it was very important for Hollywood stars not to look shiny. Why not? Because looking shiny is organic residue and also sweat, right? It's sweat, it's primitive, right? But what I'm really interested in with NMA Wan and also Josephine Baker, who's the other figure that I've been working with a lot, is that they sort of take on shine, but it's not in that, it's not an organic shine. It's not the shine of sweat. Earlier with Mabel, I mean, she is sweating a lot. She's all glistening and, you know, and she mops herself with a, you know, handkerchief and all this stuff. Her shininess is totally metallic, right? It's inorganic. And so it doesn't partake of the corporeal history of shine. It actually partakes of, I think, of a different, a much more synthetic, right, plastic history. So that's shine. Now Claire Kendry, Passing, which I think is amazingly interesting, and I've written a little bit about that story too. But one quick thing about Claire Kendry was that what was fascinating about her was that her brightness. And I would say the similarity for me in this case would be that the brightness, because Because Claire was always described as being bright. Her bright eyes, her bright hair, you know, her bright dress. She's always very bright, right? She's like, she's compared to a candle even at some point, right? She's like a light, right? She's a flame. But that brightness, I think similarly to this moment, serve as a medium that actually, it's not a static, it's actually an agent that allows a kind of ambivalence to rest upon Claire. Because the funny thing about Claire is that every time Larson describes her as whatever darkness, it's always immediately accompanied by whiteness, right? So her dark eye against her ivory skin, her darkness against her, I mean, it's always constantly this, you know, and there's always this implication that, and that the white, I mean, what's interesting is like if you look at the description of Claire Kentry, not the plot, right? The plot suggests she's white looking so she passes successfully and she's beautiful, blah, blah, blah. But when you look at a description of Claire Kentry, her beauty is always about tension, right? Blackness and light, whiteness and something murky, right? So it's always this tension. And that tension is actually, I think, what in fact makes her fascinating, right? It's not that she looks white, it's that she looks like she is somewhere, so she's neither white nor black, right? And that shine about Claire, I think actually negotiate that difference. Yeah, negotiate the differences that she embodies. Right? I don't know if that answers your question, but I think that there's a very interesting way in which it is actually her shine is the thing that enables her to be black and white at the same time. Which is something that it's in the description of her. It's not in the plot, right? The plot just tells you she's white-looking, but the description of her actually doesn't quite do that. It's a good question. Yeah. It's a very good question. And in fact, Semper was a sort of an architectural architect and an architectural critic, but something of an amateur ethnographer. Right, and actually, what I think is very interesting about Semper, and the reason why I've been reading him a lot, is actually because he has his reputation for being precisely that. Right, what you just said. But in fact, when you read his work, he is incredibly interesting because he actually says that you know we always go to ornamentation as ethnographic evidence, right? But in fact, when you go to ornamentation, you see that ornamentation is a history of miscegenation and borrowing. Right. So we think, you know, we have this idea that, you know, an archaeologist, for example, digs up, you know, a headdress in an Egyptian tomb, and he says, this is Egyptian style, right? But Semper says that is not Egyptian style. It is an Egyptian style borrowed from the Greeks, right? And so he actually does this really interesting, like for him, I think ornamentation, even though he starts out the kind of ethnographic, you know, like he'll go to different exotic parts of the world to do his research, but I actually think he also does something interesting, which is opens up the possibility of the way in which ornamentation, and he keeps calling it an artifact, right, exists not as ethnographic evidence, but as a kind of portable ecology, right, that they actually move, they travel, and they don't say anything. They say a lot more about cultural hybridity than they do about cultural homogeny, you know. So I actually think that she is doing something different, interesting here, which is to say, a lot of people have read her costume as a kind of bad Orientalism, right? Where she goes and picks out a costume, and you can say, well, that doesn't look Chinese at all. We all know that's much more Thai than Chinese, and you know. And her robe is more Korean than, and that this is just like a bad faith, that's sort of British, you know, anything that's Asiatic looking is Oriental, right? And that certainly might be the case. But it's interesting to think about how perhaps, in fact, she is actually importing all these different Asiatic elements, right, and remapping this world. You know, because she, as a character, she was very deliberate about, and when she was in the shop, there were, you know, much more obviously Chinese-looking dresses and stuff like that, and she didn't want any of that, right? And it's not Valentine who chooses costume, she did, right, the character did. So I actually think that it's interesting to think about how, instead of seeing this as a kind of like Orientalist conflation of difference, that maybe, in fact, she is, in fact, calling upon a various sort of Asiatic geography, right, and importing it into the middle of this club, which has no room for that geography, really. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I actually think that part of the non-diegetic quality is that I take it as, and this I don't have a really good proof for this, except I take it as a very, it does feel extra-diegetic, but it also feels psychic, like interior. It's like her music, you know? And I think it's not a, it's clearly not, it's clearly a piece of Western music aimed to sound like something Oriental, right? Insofar as it's, you know, it's slow and you have the banjo player in the back and, you know, it has that kind of, but I think its function is much more primary, the contrast against the music associated with Mabel, which is the sort of whole 20s jazzy, not jazzy, but more, but quick, you know, quick music, right? And hers is incredibly slow and dreamy. And so I'm not quite sure. You know, I think you're right to say that it sounds extra-diegetic. And the question for us is, like, what is the function of that? Why is it other? Why is the music other? You know, it's not other because it's Orientalist. It's not that Oriental, right? But I think it's other because it is actually tracking. I think its most important function is to have this kind of dreamy, static quality, right, to it. And what I think is interesting about the static quality is that if you think about, well, what I think is kind of interesting, that the history of dance, right, that we think about dance, when we think dance, we think action, right? But it is actually not true that historically dance has been associated with motion. It only became associated with motion in the 20th century. And the person to read about this is André Lopecki, has a book called Exhausted Dance, in which he actually does a sort of history of dance. And that dance, I mean, specifically as linked with motion, right, activity, is a very modern idea. And what's interesting about this scene is that Mabel, who actually does this sort of like Charleston-ish, American-ish, jazzy performance, right, is being contrasted against this dance, which is in many ways old-fashioned. Old-fashioned in the sense that it doesn't move that much. This is, you're just very concentric. She has a stage. She doesn't move more than 3 feet, right, within that circle. And so I think that, you know, what I've been trying to do is understand what that stillness is about, you know, and understand that stillness, you know, maybe not necessarily as another aspect of objectification, though it certainly could be that, but also as a kind of an active resistance against a performing body. I mean, what's funny about this, you know, like if we read this thing as a moment where she is being made to labor the way she was laboring as a dishwasher. By the way, she was not a very good dishwasher, because when Valentine went down to find her, she was dancing on top of a table instead of washing dishes. And the reason why he went down to the scullery, to the basement, is because a customer complained of a dirty dish. So in fact, she was never a very good laborer, right, as a laborer. And if you think about her as dancing to earn her keep, it's Mabel who danced to earn her keep. Mabel, who was also, the implication is in the movie, is that she's a little bit older, it's a little bit harder for her to do this dance, right? So it's all about her labor. Whereas Xiuxiu, she's hardly moving, right? And there's something, I think, actually rather powerful about her refusal to move in this movie, you know, in various ways. She's a very stubborn and possessive character. She wants to own everything. I don't know how to make sense of it, but well, except, you know, in some ways it's quite obvious, right, that for people who are being objectified and dehumanized, ontology is not something to scoff at, right? I mean, it's one thing to say, I think it's really important, it's one thing to critique authenticity in ontology, it's another to deny their function, right? That we can critique authenticity, but we must all live as authentic beings. If we don't, we'd be like a Beckett character. That's why you can't be a Beckett character, because you can't have your ontology scattered, right, as a person, right? So it's a necessary fiction, right? So that's one thing. One reason it persists because it's a necessary fiction. The other reason it persists is because it's the foundation on which we base so much of our political platform, right? For, you know, even civil rights, even our civil rights today, if you think about our laws, our civil rights law, it's all based on really essential biology and ontology, right? So, for example, so our rights protect you for what you are, but not for what you do, right? So you cannot be fired for being black or being gay, but you can be fired for wearing cornrows or for flaunting your gay marriage. And these are real cases, right? so that our civil rights itself is attached to a notion of that which is immutable, the immutable traits, right? But part of what I hope my project is at least get people to start talking about, is thinking about, is how that is highly problematic, right? Even by the law cases that I just cited, highly problematic. So how do we actually really radically reimagine the foundation on which we as a nation base rights? And you're right, it is still ontology, and it's very hard to get away from it. And you cannot get, you cannot get completely away from it because we're people, you know. But it seems really important to think about something alongside of it, you know, not instead of it, but alongside of it.
Thank you.
Okay.
There's a reception up there, so there's tons of goodies, so please eat it. So thank you.